From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. President Bush went on a grand tour of Europe this week, the first of his presidency, and if you had read the advance word from the old world, you would have guessed the streets would not be strewn with rose petals. Here's a clip from the president's stop in Sweden, reported by the BBC this week.
They call Gothenburg the friendly city. That's not how it looked just now. Early this afternoon, the police clashed with around 200 protesters who'd thrown bottles and stones. The demonstrators were forced to retreat to a nearby park. And this is why they're here. The man they called the Toxic Texan, who withdrew American participation in the Kyoto Accord on climate change.
Even the president's itinerary was fodder for critics. He skipped the big players, notably Germany and France, for less influential nations like Spain and Slovenia. He seemed to favor crowned heads over duly elected leaders, and he only managed to squeeze in Russian President Alexander Putin for a couple of hours at the end of his trip. Then there were the contentious issues of the Kyoto Accords the U.S. has failed to sign, the unpopular missile defense system the president advocates, and the execution of Timothy McVeigh.
So, all in all, the European news media was not favorably inclined toward George W. Bush when he embarked upon his trip. Martin Walker is the chief international correspondent of UPI International. We called him in Sweden and asked what the European press was expecting to see.
Well, they were expecting a slightly reformed alcoholic, totally ignorant of affairs outside his native Texas, obsessed with capital punishment, and determined to ram down the throats of the world an American-first ideology, which said we will protect America from missiles and nobody else, and we will also refuse to do things like sign the Kyoto Protocol to avoid global warming. And La Repubblica of Italy routinely now refers to the American president as the executioner-in-chief. The cover of Spiegel, one of the great German weeklies, shows Bush as a wild-eyed cowboy, and their headline is The Ugly American. You've got in Le Figaro of France, the Toxic Texan. You've had in Sweden that this is the man who sends us dirty air and now tries to destabilize Europe.
I assume there was a big difference between the left-wing and the right-wing press.
Not so much as you'd... I mean, I was very surprised that there wasn't that much, because after all, Figaro in France is a conservative newspaper. They're the ones who call him the Toxic Texan.
I understand that the Telegraph and the Spanish paper El País and El Mundo took somewhat positive takes on the president.
Well, with a bit of a difference. El País and El Mundo in Spain were both delighted that Bush was starting off his trip in Spain. The Daily Telegraph was really rather split. It's a very conservative British newspaper. Some of them said that Bush was the kind of conservative Europeans really ought to appreciate, but also there was a sense that Bush was starting to play fast and loose with the traditional Anglo-American alliance, and that therefore he ought to be treated with some caution. And I think that what's been interesting is that we have had a certain amount of suspicion of Bush from the conservative wing in Europe as well as from the traditional left wing in Europe.
Does that come from his position on the Kyoto Accords and missile defense or something else?
I think it comes from three separate things. First of all, it's the Kyoto Accords, because everybody in Europe does take global warming very seriously. I think on missile defense, an awful lot of conservatives in Europe were simply worried that he was getting rid of a tried and tested security system and not putting anything else in its place. The third reason was that this sense of vulnerability about the idea that Europeans and Americans shared common values. Well, we certainly do on human rights, but when it comes to common values, the death penalty really is a major issue for conservatives and for left-wingers alike in Europe.
The Bush trip, unhappily for Bush, I think, coincided exactly with the execution of Timothy McVeigh. That played a part in some of his initial coverage anyway, didn't it?
It played a very big part. This whole issue of capital punishment is really a very burning one in Europe, because, of course, you can't be a member of either the European Union nor of the Council of Europe if your state supports capital punishment.
Were there comparisons made between President Clinton and President Bush in the papers you read?
Absolutely. The comparisons were, please bring back President Clinton, all is forgiven. That was in the Irish Times. Mm-hmm. And there was a comment also that went on in the Irish Times to say that the thing about Clinton was that he had a European sense of warmth and compassion.
And the Texas bonhomie and Mr. Bush's much-vaunted charm offensive fell on deaf ears?
Well, before he arrived, it certainly didn't seem to get any response. What has been remarkable since his arrival is that the story has changed. There is no longer, I think, a consensus among European politicians that Bush is a dangerous destabilizer who wants to poison the planet. The consensus is now becoming, well, this is the guy we're going to have to live with for the next 4 years, perhaps the next 8 years, and he's prepared to talk to us. He's saying he's not a unilateralist, he wants to listen. He is, in person, quite a charming fellow, and as a result, we are prepared to work with him. After all, we don't have much choice.
And so then, have the media been behind the curve about the reality in which this diplomacy played out, or are they on top of it?
I think the media in Europe have been about, 3 months behind the curve. I think the media in the US have been a few weeks behind the curve. But I think that the reality is going to start catching up, because we are going to have to start writing that so far, at least until the meeting with Putin, Bush has had a serious success on his European tour. He has come out onto the world stage for the first time and has been, I think, a pretty reasonable figure.
Martin Walker, it was a pleasure talking to you.
And to you.
Martin Walker is the chief international correspondent for UPI International.
Earlier this week, the execution of Oklahoma bomber Timothy McVeigh dominated the news, with the attention divided between the bereaved in Oklahoma and elsewhere and the events in the death chamber at Terre Haute. Among the witnesses to the execution were 10 members of the media. Two of those witnesses join us now, Karen Grundin of the Terre Haute Tribune Star and Byron Pitts of CBS News, who obtained his seat through a lottery operated by the Bureau of Prisons. Karen, did you have any misgivings, or did you think you were going to come through it okay?
You know, I actually was pretty certain that I wouldn't have a problem with that. I've gone out to accident scenes before and shootings and that sort of thing as the police and courts reporter at the Tribune Star. So, you know, from those experiences, I figured I probably would be okay with watching the execution.
Because you've seen dead bodies?
Correct.
It's the same?
No, it's not the same at all when you're actually watching someone die compared to seeing someone who is already dead. Witnessing this execution, you actually saw the color of Timothy McVeigh's skin change as those drugs were coursing through his body. So it was quite different.
What about the night before? Were you sleepless?
Definitely. I actually got to bed about 10 p.m. and knew I had to get up around 2. I remember looking at the clock quite a few times and remember looking at it at 1:55 a.m. and thinking, there's no reason to wait for the wake-up call. I might as well just go ahead and get up.
Byron Pitts, what happened to you when you saw the drugs coursing through Timothy McVeigh's body? I mean, did your respiration change? Were you nervous, upset?
No, not at all. I watched. I was so busy, like Karen and everyone else, taking as many notes as I could, trying to, keep my game face on, if you will, that I didn't have any inner reaction as it happened.
Have you had any post-execution stress symptoms?
No. I mean, it's been a few days now, but this is my second execution. It's about the fifth time in life I've actually seen someone die. And it's always been my sense, it seems to me, that with each death, it almost has like its own fingerprints. I mean, each experience was very different. Two were executions. One was a dear friend of mine who was stabbed to death in front of me when I was 12. The other, my grandmother, she was 90. I watched her die. Those other instances, I mean, they bothered me. They stayed with me for quite a while. Those people did nothing to deserve to die at that moment. With the two executions, whether you agree or disagree with the death penalty, it seems to me that both men had some appreciation that if I commit these crimes, this could happen to me. And so they had some control over how their lives ended.
How about you, Karen? Was it difficult before, during, or after?
Unlike Byron, I had never really watched someone die before. And so, I'll give it a little more time, but I just don't see that I'm going to have any anguish over it.
Byron, you were there because you were the lottery winner. Karen, you because you work for the Tribune Star. In the larger sense, though, why were you there? Why did the media need to be present for this?
Well, you know, I think that part of our role is to make sure that the execution is carried out as the government has said it would be. As best as we can determine that from witnessing it, that is part of our role, and our other role is to report what we saw.
Byron?
My mother raised me. She used to always say, said, son, the truth may hurt, the truth may be funny, it may be ugly, but the truth is always the truth. And so, therefore, I think there is some value as journalists in witnessing things, regardless of what that might be, if given the opportunity to, hopefully, when it's over, report to people what it is that you saw fairly and as objectively as you could.
Having seen what you've seen, do you think that televising capital punishment will alter the debate in this country? Karen?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that it would. You know, I think it may depend on how the execution was carried out, whether it was a lethal injection or maybe some other form of execution. In my case, it didn't. It may just be an individual sort of thing.
I would agree. I would think that most people would look at it and would be surprised at how clinical the whole process is and how void of emotion the moment is, how disciplined the people who carry it out are. Again, in most cases, when it goes the way it's designed to go. 10 journalists, we all saw it. We all were there to be objective. But I think all of us, on some level, saw different things. So I'm not sure if witnessing an execution would do a whole lot to shift the nation's debate, though I think it might.
Karen, your beat as criminal justice reporter at the Terre Haute Tribune Star is such that you'll be witnessing other executions. Any fear about that? Do you think you can witness too many? Something can happen to you?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure. I mean, I would think that maybe there would be a point where there would be too many. I'm not really sure how many more I will witness. There's the possibility I will witness Juan Raúl Garza's if it goes as scheduled on Tuesday. As far as whether that'll be a problem, you know, if it goes like Mr. McVeigh's execution did, I don't see that I would have a problem with that, but it's another thing I'll just have to wait and see about, really.
Is this something you want to get used to?
No, I don't think you want to get used to witnessing an execution. To become calloused against, you know, death or, you know, a lethal injection, I don't think would be a good thing at all.
All right, Karen Grundin, thank you very much for joining us. Karen Grundin of the Terre Haute Tribune Star and Byron Pitts of CBS News, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up in Athletes Media Makeover, false advertising from a phantom critic, and England's Cyber Woodstock. Also, Motley Crue gets the Faulkner treatment.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A few years ago, sports columnist Michael Wilbon of the Washington Post foresaw Allen Iverson's life and career ending in ruin. Taking note of the Philadelphia 76er rookie's criminal record, his cornrows and tattoos, his disrespect for authority, his thuggish posse, and his gangsta image, Wilbon predicted Iverson would in time reap what he sowed. As recently as October, when the violent, abusive lyrics from Iverson's still unreleased rap album emerged, Wilbon declared his sports writer vigil, The Wait for Iverson to Grow Up, to be in vain. That was then. This is now.
Allen Iverson, who has 47 points. He heard it before the game when he was presented the MVP trophy, and he's here.
The gutsy, blindingly fast little off-guard, the one they call The Answer, suddenly is a new man. NBC and TNT sportscasters marveled at his maturity. ABC News says he has turned his life around. David Dupree, writing in USA Today, declared Iverson's image repaired. In the past month, a dozen newspaper stories from around the country invoked the word transform, and Wilbon himself marveled at Iverson's change in professional attitude, in the columnist's words, just like that. And here is Sports Illustrated writer Rick Riley on CNBC's Hardball with Chris Matthews.
Have we changed in our view of Allen Iverson? Rick Riley.
Well, I think definitely. I mean, I think we definitely have changed. And he's one of the fine, young, great talents in the league. And I happen to think a young man who's really become a good person.
Well, that was rapid. Nobody who covers the NBA questions whether Iverson's dedication to basketball and team play improved dramatically in this season, a season in which Iverson's MVP performance propelled Philadelphia to the playoff finals. But how does that translate to a mythic conversion from irredeemable to redeemed?
The media, especially the sports media in this country, is so black or white. Atomic war or eternal peace. You know, there's nothing in between. New York Yankees, all-time greatest team, bunch of bums, trade all of them.
Sports journalist Keith Olbermann, formerly of ESPN and the Fox Sports Network, was wary of the demonized Iverson portrayal as the seed of the NBA's destruction, and he's wary of the conversion portrayal as well.
I'm not sold. I mean, if there's a real, genuine transformation in the man's personality, more power to him, and I hope the other sports commentators have simply been more discerning than I have.
For the record, Michael Wilbon of the Washington Post isn't sold on the notion that there's been a radical swing in the conventional wisdom about the answer.
I completely reject out of hand the notion that the world has gone soft on Allen Iverson. I read too much and see too much to the contrary.
The proof, however, will be in the pudding. Who knows? Maybe even Jell-O pudding.
Now he is more marketable than he was 2 or 3 months ago, or certainly 3 or 4 years ago. The experts seem to think that his appeal is still targeted towards the youth market, maybe the extreme sports market.
Richard Sandomir is the sports media reporter of the New York Times. He wrote during the finals how Iverson's rehabilitation has increased his marketability for advertising endorsements. While he's still not a clean-cut Michael Jordan type, Sandomir says, on-court heroics have allowed him to shed the pariah tag that kept mainstream marketers far, far away.
Winning helps. Not getting arrested helps. Looking like someone who has become the consummate team player and will play with immense pain has transformed him in the eyes of the world.
But there is at least one more sneaker to drop. Sometime this summer, Iverson's long-delayed rap album is expected to be released, including the song 40 Bars that so horrified mainstream audiences 5 months ago. If, as Michael Wilbon reports, the album is filled with material as caustic as 40 Bars, the media conventional wisdom can change yet again. Keith Olbermann.
When the album is released and there's not a significant change in that 40 Bars, I just suggest once again that you can be in a position where you are the hero and then the villain and then the hero and then the villain.
Neither of which extremes, of course, will ever be entirely true, no matter what the PAC journalism tells us.
F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote that there is no second acts in American lives. Allen Iverson's proved them wrong. The 6-foot guard for the Philadelphia 76ers had been the poster boy for everything that's wrong with the hip-hop generation. Now he's a winner, and Iverson, who's been playing in pain for weeks, has become the hero.
This week, at least. Let's ask again a little later, because after all, they say there are no foolish questions, but there are sometimes foolish answers.
This month, two Eager Beaver PR reps for Sony Pictures were suspended when they were caught fabricating movie blurbs for TV ads. The Sony marketeers created David Manning of the Ridgefield Press, a Connecticut weekly that actually does exist. Then they quoted him saying nice things about Sony movies, including The Animal and A Knight's Tale. Sony was shocked, and sorry, but the company may soon be even sorrier. Two disappointed moviegoers in California are suing Sony for false advertising, and the La Jolla-based law firm of Blumenthal and Markham are hoping to make it into a class action suit. Attorney David Markham is on the line from La Jolla. Mr. Markham, is your client blaming Sony because he bought a ticket to A Knight's Tale?
the positive review of the film was one of the things, according to Rezek, that caused him to go and buy a ticket and see the film.
So does he think Sony owes him $12?
He, at this point, thinks that Sony owes the amount of money which Sony derived from selling this movie as a result of running the false ad. In other words, how much in ticket sales would Sony have made without the false review versus how much would they have made with the false review?
Which is probably impossible to determine.
It is, and so California law solves the problem another way. The law says that you engage in what's called deterrence so that, you know, the next week a person selling a car or a person selling a pair of shoes doesn't make a statement about it which is false. So we don't have really a damage claim, but there is a disgorgement claim.
So the message here is Sony should pay for lying.
Yeah, the message is that Sony should not profit for engaging in false advertising, making up lies, statements, false critics. They shouldn't profit by it, and that's what the statute says.
How much money are you looking at?
We don't really know, but you're looking at most likely a percentage of what their ticket sales were.
Right, but are you talking 100,000, half a million, a million? 2 million?
We don't. I'm sure you're well north of $1 million, and it really depends on what you see when you look at the revenues with regard to each of the respective movies.
You know, out here in New York, we have something called Nathan's Hot Dogs, and they say they're the best hot dogs in the world, and I've had them, and they just aren't. Should I sue them?
There is somewhat of a difference between the expression of an opinion and a statement of fact.
The fictional David Manning said that The Knight's Tale was a winner.
Sure, but did Nathan's say, Julia Child has sampled our hot dogs, and she thinks they're the best hot dogs in the world. And if Julia Child did not do so, then Nathan's is exposed for false advertising.
So if Sony had come out and said, our film is a winner, you'd have no case.
Well, you would have an expression of an opinion rather than a statement of fact. If you state, for example, a critic has reviewed my movie positively or given it an endorsement when no critic exists, you're in the realm of fact rather than in the realm of opinion.
This is a case of somebody who read a review, spent $12. They probably should have known better, but don't you think you're going to get laughed out of court?
No. What do we do with the law if we tell people, well, listen, you know, it's okay, you can lie, you can hype your product in any way you want to, fine, go ahead and do it because the product you sell is worth less than $15. So why do you need to comply with the law on false advertising that governs every other business in the state? In other words, where do you draw the line?
Dave Markham, thank you very much.
Oh, sure.
Dave Markham is an attorney with Blumenthal and Markham, which is now attempting to bring to trial a case against Sony for false advertising.
In 1970, farmer Michael Evis opened up the slatted wooden gates to his land in the southwest of England for a weekend of free music and communing with nature. Over the following 30 years, this small hippie gathering morphed into a massive annual event, attracting hundreds of thousands of people who wanted to listen to the latest chart-topping bands or mainly roll around in the mud and share the experience of overused porta-johns. But as the world has become ever more technologically advanced, so too has the Glastonbury Festival. This year, pixels will replace the mud, and a search engine will take the place of a hilltop view. George Mackay is the author of Glastonbury, A Very English Fair. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Before we get to the latest development in the life of this festival, can you please explain the place that the Glastonbury Festival holds in the collective consciousness of the Brits?
Glastonbury has something special about it because even though it has indeed morphed into this huge, mega, mass event, you know, with hundreds of thousands of people, it claims that it still has an ethos of alternative values and culture and green issues about it.
Ethos of alternative values, although there are gigantic masts for the cellular phones and chain food outlets pitching their tents next to the green dreadlocked men selling veggie patties.
Yeah, it's set in this beautiful, absolutely beautiful valley, a stunning place. which, as legend has it, is indeed the Vale of Avalon, Avalon being the secret island where King Arthur was buried to rise up at a future date to kind of reinvent the English. You know, there's this sort of spiritual dimension to Glastonbury. And then, as well as that, you've got 200,000 people, all their motor cars, their pollution, their mobile phones, and et cetera, et cetera. I think those contradictions, rather than, you know, it's almost too easy to say that they've undercut the original ethos and that that's all been lost in a sort of sponsored corporate world. I think the contradictions of Glastonbury have energized it, really, and have kept it interesting and kept it a bit alternative, even while all these other things are going on around it.
Okay, but this year, however the festival has evolved in the past, there's a genuine technological sea change, because there will be no Glastonbury Festival on former Evis's land this year. What is replacing it?
Instead of everyone congregating as pilgrims at Glastonbury this year in those special green fields, we have instead a virtual Glastonbury. You have to log onto the net and you will get some sense of the spirituality, so the website claims, from the web itself.
Putting aside for a moment the very genuine difference in the experience of recorded music versus live music, if Glastonbury is about the experience, about the community, how in the world is any of that conveyed over a computer?
It isn't. Glastonbury is a mass event. It's about the crowd. It almost doesn't matter who the headliners are each year. In fact, lots of people I spoke to, well, I didn't really see any bands. You know, people saying, oh, who's on? Are they? Oh, I don't think I'll bother with that. I like it up here in the Stone Circle. Or I like it here in the Teepee Circle. And so it's almost like the crowd becomes its own entertainment. And you simply don't get that in the solitary, the sole experience of logging onto the web and looking at your computer screen.
And that seems so clear. Why in the world are they going through with this exercise?
I think Glastonbury is at a moment of crisis. Michael Evis, the farmer who has organized it since the earliest days in 1970, you know, he's getting on a bit. And he's quite keen, I think, to pass the event on, the organization of it, to his daughter, Emily. But if that doesn't happen, where does that festival go? And so I think they're trying to kind of do a bridge, really, this year and then build it up again for next year. Because if they don't, there's a sense that it may begin to fade away.
Well, if this is just a bookmark, if they're just holding a place for the festival to resume in some later date, do you think that can ever happen? Or do you think the life cycle of Glastonbury has played out and that it's just in its final stages?
Sometimes indeed, yeah. The life cycle is finished, and it may be that Glastonbury has got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then there was a mega event, almost too large an event last year, and that maybe that says it's time to stop, you know. And where Glastonbury lives is in our memories and in the folk culture and in the sort of traditions of alternative culture which are continually being rewritten and re-explored by cultural studies academics like myself.
Very well. George Mackay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
George Mackay is a professor of cultural studies at the University of Central Lancashire.
You know I'm a dreamer, but my heart's of gold. I had a runaway.
Rock stars. They light up the night sky like the gods of yore, only to be snuffed out in a whirlwind of drugs, debauchery, and tortured metaphors like this one. At least that's the formula for the popular VH1 program Behind the Music. The show is so popular, the storytelling formula so ironclad, the tales so familiar, that to think of the story of a popular musician is to think of Behind the Music. But what about when it doesn't work? Joining me now is New York Times pop music writer Neil Strauss, who, along with the members of the heavy metal band Motley Crue, wrote a weighty collective biography of the band called Dirt. Neil Strauss, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Now, I think one notable thing about the book is that it veers away from the tried and true Behind the Music formula. That's generally a three-act play.
Right. The, you know, the rise, the fall, the redemption, you know, and all, you know, and the tearful apology, I was wrong at the end.
And how many acts does your book, The Dirt, have?
It's probably got about 30 acts per Motley Crue member. I mean, it's real life. Sometimes people don't always learn from their mistakes.
So for some of them, at least, no redemption at all.
Right. Or a little redemption. Some parts are redeemed. Some parts aren't redeemed. You know, I think whether it's you or me or Motley Crue, you learn from some mistakes, but then you go ahead and you make new ones.
Some of these people don't seem to learn a damn thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're amazed that these guys are still alive, and even while I was working on it, they're still getting arrested. They're still, you know, causing all kinds of mayhem, women problems, what have you.
What do you think of Behind the Music's treatment of most rock groups?
Well, yeah, I think, I mean, it's the problem that anyone has, whether you're a band or a TV producer. You do something and it works, and then you decide, hey, that's our formula. So that's why the Motley Crue episode, which is one of the early ones, worked so well. And after a while, you almost feel like people are going on Behind the Music, so they're scripting their three-act before they're going on it, so the later ones are less effective. And you see them almost trying to move away from their formula now, like Behind the Music of the 80s are a concept now.
But the Behind the Music they did on Motley Crue, they were redeemed at the end, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
Are you saying VH1 lied to us?
Yes. I think that this is what I've sort of am starting to learn a little bit, which is this, that it's okay to talk about all the drugs and decadence you've done as long as you pretend like you're not doing them anymore. I mean, having spent some time with some of the musicians who appear on other episodes of Behind the Music, you know, I know that they're high on camera talking about how they've cleaned up.
What did the musicians think of that form?
I guess it's a little self-exploitation for publicity. I mean, I think they'd all be glad, you know, they'd all be glad to be on it. As long as you're redeemed at the end, it's all okay.
But they don't buy it. They don't believe it.
No, they believe it. Like, when they see it, they believe it. You know, the media has a way of making something seem true. And I'm not saying that it's a lie, but it's definitely, you know, I'm sure you shape it to fit a, you know, you shape it to fit a format.
So let's go back to the dirt. What kind of structure were you going for there?
The structure of the dirt was, if you read it, you're not gonna think about it or care about it, but As It Lay Dying by William Faulkner, that was my inspiration because, you know, it's a book about a family traveling to bury their mother, and each different chapter is told from a different family member's point of view. And, you know, some are lovable, some are crazy, some are retarded. And I'm not saying that about the band, of course.
Of course.
But you get the different pieces of the story. Some of them contradict, some of them don't make sense, but between it you get a whole in three dimensions. And that's what I was trying for. And in As I Lay Dying, along the way, different neighbors might comment from an outside perspective on the passing of this Motley party. And, you know, so I had different strangers comment on Motley in that way. I told them when I was starting it, I said, like, that this is my idea for it. Are you down with doing it in this structure?
And did they say rad?
They said rad, dude. It's not like I always take a band and then apply a literary construct to it, but with Marilyn Manson, the Inferno was the model. And the idea was he was kind of trying to show his fall from innocence to this twisted, dark persona of Marilyn Manson. So we plotted the falls along the lines of the different circles of the Inferno. And that was something he actively participated in.
So Dante from Marilyn Manson and Faulkner from Motley Crue.
Exactly.
I guess that leaves Jane Austen from Michael Jackson.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Neil Strauss is author of The Dirt, Motley Crue.
Coming up, network TV loses its sole religion reporter, market research on TV's Angels, and the dark side of HBO.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Last year, more than 16 million viewers tuned into ABC to watch Peter Jennings reporting The Search for Jesus. Jennings and his network have long claimed that audiences like that emphasize the importance of religion in its reporting and specials. But in ABC's latest round of money-saving moves, network television's only dedicated religion reporter, Peggy Wehmeyer, didn't make the cut. filling the void, or trying to at least, is BeliefNet.com, a website that bills itself as a multimedia company for religion and spirituality. Joining us now is Charles Haynes, a senior scholar at the Freedom Forum's First Amendment Center in Roslyn, Virginia. Charles, welcome to OTM.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So ABC has let go Peggy Wehmeyer. Is this more evidence that we have a godless media?
Well, I think it's a bad message at a bad time. Just when we thought things were getting better in terms of religion coverage, it sends the message that religion is expendable.
In fact, ABC has kind of used Peggy as a poster child for their commitment to religion coverage. They've been the only network in the last number of years to have a full-time religion correspondent.
Well, we've all been using her as a poster person. I mean, we've pointed to her and said, look, things are getting better. A network now has a full-time religion reporter. So now we don't have anyone to point to. It is disturbing.
Apart from the coverage of the religious right in politics in the United States, and maybe ethnic and religious rivalries in the Balkans and in Africa and elsewhere, the whole coverage of religion in mainstream media seems to be quite ghettoized. Do you think that's true as well?
Oh, I think so. I think it's treated as something people used to believe a long, long time ago, but is not really that important today unless there's a conflict. But religious events in and of themselves or developments that affect the lives of millions of people, that doesn't seem to be newsworthy.
If you were the Sultan, how would things change?
Well, I think that journalism schools ought to consider requiring that journalists have some background in religious studies. I mean, we're the most religiously diverse nation in the entire world. We, among developed nations, we're the most religious people. And yet our journalists, by and large, come out into the field and are unprepared to deal with all of that.
You're not suggesting that reporters themselves have to be spiritual or believers, but
no,
that they have to understand the society that they're reporting in and on.
These are not religious arguments for taking religion seriously. That's not appropriate for journalism, and I'm not making those arguments. These are really civic arguments. That is to say, if we're going to be fair in our press, in our media, we've got to really let the voices be heard. We've got to be attentive to who lives in the country and what they care about.
You would never send a reporter to cover Washington, for example, without him understanding how Congress works, the separation of powers, and you know how a bill becomes law. And yet the same people aren't conversant at all in all manner of religious questions.
Yes, and this is really a dangerous thing because many Americans, I think, have given up on seeing themselves in the media and understanding themselves in the media. So we have a kind of divided nation. We have well, Peter Berger, the sociologist, says that, you know, Sweden is the least religious country in the world, perhaps, and India the most religious. And America is an interesting combination of the two. It's a nation of Indians ruled by Swedes.
So what's the root of all this? Is it that the questions of religion are so loaded and so complicated that we're just afraid in the media to cover them?
I think there is a fear because out of really lack of understanding. I mean, we've gone through a period in the United States where we really had a tough time figuring out the proper role of religion in public life. And I think that the path of least resistance has been to ignore it, to say, well, the solution is just to that's a private matter, let's keep it out. And I really wonder how the United States is going to make it as a nation, how we're going to live with all of these differences if we don't understand one another, if we don't know anything about one another. And I should think on that basis alone, the press should take religion seriously by reporting accurately and fairly the various perspectives, the religious perspectives and others, of the American people.
Excellent point. Is it going to happen?
Well, this latest symbolic move by ABC has sort of made me less optimistic about what's going to happen. I hope the partnership with BeliefNet turns out to prove me wrong, that ABC will do more coverage. I hope so.
Charles Haynes, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Charles Haynes is a senior scholar at the Freedom Forum's First Amendment Center in Roslyn, Virginia.
When test marketing TV shows, networks can't simply ask, will it play in Peoria? Because even if it does, it may not play in New York or L.A. Wouldn't it be nice, those researchers may have thought, if there were a true cultural crossroads in this country where Middle American and coastal sensibilities mingled? Guess where that is.
Viva Las Vegas!
Mike Pesca, On the Media's producer at large, reports.
The MGM Hotel and Casino has 5,000 rooms, 3,600 slot machines, and one actual living, breathing lion. The roar, however, is pre-recorded. Wolfgang Puck has a restaurant inside the MGM. Studio 54's Las Vegas branch is there. This is why it's remarkable that an increasingly popular pastime inside the MGM is watching television.
Let's take a look at the whatever that was before the county shuts us down.
The first thing you see are the words Television City spelled out in big neon letters, the default font for this town. There are a few big screen TVs playing CBS shows. Inside a small store, CBS merchandise is for sale. Young and the Restless boxer shorts retail for $24. By Vegas standards, Television City is a little underwhelming. No buffet, no showgirls, no Siegfried, no Roy. Just as you're about to turn on your heel and head back towards the lip-syncing lion, you're accosted.
Hi, we're at Television City. Would you like to see one of our new television programs?
What is it? What do I have to do?
Yeah. Well, what we're doing is we're testing the new fall lineup for CBS. What you do is you watch a new television program, and you tell us what you think about it. You get a 10% discount in our gift shop here.
Oh, really?
10%? Yeah.
You got any Young and the Restless stuff?
Television City, it turns out, is CBS's new state-of-the-art audience testing center. Las Vegas has become the demographically representative crossroads of America.
We do a test with 250 people. Without trying, we get 40 different states represented, so that's extraordinary.
David Poltrack is CBS Television's executive vice president of research and planning.
Las Vegas is a town where the action's at night. People are looking for things to do during the day.
Like watch TV. Poltrack is based in New York, but that doesn't really matter because CBS executives on both coasts can utilize live video links between their offices in Las Vegas. That way, they can watch America watch CBS. Upon entering the screening room, participants are given two push buttons, one red, one green. Then, an instructional recording is played.
This is what we'd like for you to do. When you come to a part of the program that you think is good, that you want to see and hear, please press the green button in your right hand and keep it pressed down as long as you continue to think that part is good. When you come to a part of the program that is poor, that you don't want to see or hear, press the red button in your left hand and keep it pressed down as long as that part continues.
This turned the experience of watching Touched by an Angel into one of the most judgmental 45 minutes of my life.
What's gonna happen to me?
Well, there's an angel named Andrew.
Good.
And he took your mommy to heaven.
Good.
And he's going to come in here very soon.
Bad.
And take you to meet your mommy.
Bad. I found the directions on button pushing vague. What about when bad things happen to good people? Do I press good because it's entertaining, or bad because I feel bad for the person? And what about a villain? If I press green for good, am I telling the people who read the results that they've miscast the role? These were no mere idle musings, because this episode of Touched by an Angel forced me to pass judgment on the greatest villain of all, Satan himself, as played by Mandy Patinkin.
No one here to guide you.
Bad.
Now you're on your own.
Bad. Bad. I was bad. Risking a repetitive stress injury for the opportunity to buy boxer shorts for just $21.60.
No one is alone.
It wasn't discount drawers that convinced Anita and Roseanne to participate. They're Touched by an Angel viewers who were happy to have a chance to influence the show. But they were divided as to the philosophy of good and bad button pushing.
Let's take the scene where the building explodes. I mean, did you press the red button there?
No.
Why not?
Because I know the show, and I just figured something good was going to come of bad things.
Did you ever press the red button?
No.
Did you ever press the red button?
Yeah, I did.
And well, what parts did you press the red button on?
When the little girl was going to die and the mother died in the bombing, all the sad stuff I did.
Now, this is interesting. This is what I'm hearing. I think you were using the buttons. You pressed the red button not to say how I feel, but how it's working as a TV show. And I think you used the buttons to say this is how it makes me feel. That's a sad thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. I wanted it all to be happy.
Whether they're happy with the program or the program makes them happy doesn't really matter to CBS.
Either one will satisfy advertisers who believe that a happy, conflict-free environment moves product. And what better place to determine television's effectiveness than Las Vegas, a city whose sole purpose is separating its visitors from their money as happily as possible. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
TV that makes you feel good is not what you'll find on the new HBO series, 6 Feet Under.
How's it going with you?
Oh, it's great. Great. You know, my father's dead, my mom's a whore, my brother wants to kill me, and my sister's smoking crack.
The mobsters and the Sopranos, the inmates of Oz, and even the whiny sirens of Sex and the City make HBO quite the rogues gallery. Joining me now is Tad Friend, staff writer of The New Yorker, who's written an article about the cable TV channel. Tad, why are the shows on HBO so dark?
Oddly enough, they are actually physically dark. If you look at the screen, there will be fewer pixels or lumens or whatever it is on the screen. And a lot of network producers have told me that when they make a show, they often film it darker than they want it to be because they know that when it goes to the network feed, they're going to wash it with light to make it seem more cheerful, more happy, more upbeat. As far as the thematic darkness, one of the people I spoke with for my article is Scott Sasso, the head of NBC, and he pointed out that HBO is for people who feel underserved by network television. That was his phrase. Right now, the networks, because they are designed to get advertisers, are doing a lot of shows that are very cheerful and upbeat and optimistic. So HBO really, in a way, they keep a constant eye to what the networks are doing and say, if the networks are doing what we're doing something wrong.
In your article, the creator of 6 Feet Under, Alan Ball, who also wrote American Beauty, told you that he was so excited to work on a show for HBO because he wouldn't have to worry about commercials. But it isn't just halting his story every 15 minutes that he resented about commercial TV. There was a whole host of things.
Yes. He created a show for ABC the year before called Oh, Grow Up, which was a very bad sitcom. Actually, it was amazingly bad, given that he did such wonderful work on American Beauty. And the reason it was bad, he says, and I would have to agree with him, is that the network basically told him no conflict, no subtext. Everything should be explained very clearly to the viewer. No one should fight. And he pointed out to me, he said, you know, drama is conflict and subtext. If you take those two things out, you have network television.
Where network TV is concerned, what they want to do is deliver eyeballs to advertisers. What they want to do on cable, or at least HBO, is right. Deliver subscribers into the system. So how does that change the kind of programming that you're pitching at them?
Well, the networks don't make any money if they have 50 million people watching a show and there are no advertisers who want to advertise on that show. Advertisers, to be grossly simplistic, want their people who are looking at their advertisements to be in a cheerful, happy, pleasant, mildly tranquilized mood. HBO already has people who have paid for this service. Its job is to keep them paying for it at the end of every month. It means you can have very different kind of programming. Jeff Bukas, the head of the network, told me that last year when they put on a show called The Corner, which was a miniseries about crack addicts, mostly in Baltimore, it was a very dark, very bleak show. And he was saying, we'd rather put that on and maybe get much smaller ratings than we would with something that would attract 35% of our audience, as long as we get good critical reception and we reach people who are not being reached by other kinds of shows on HBO.
You said that HBO made more money than any other network. In fact, and I really find this hard to believe, you say that HBO made more money than the other networks combined.
Two of the network heads I spoke to, Les Moon was at CBS and Scott Sasso at NBC, both frankly said, boy, do I envy HBO. That's a much better business to be in. The networks are just, you know, their audience share has been dropping for the last 25 years. Right now, the network's business is a terrible business to be in. There's sort of no end in sight.
You said that an HBO employee said it was important if the Shaleses got excited, you know, the Tom Shales, the TV critics. Here's what Tom Shales said in his Washington Post review about 6 Feet Under. He said, 6 Feet Under establishes from the start that it will be unflinching and brazen and, as it happens, scorchingly brilliant. So then if the networks pander to the mass audience, isn't HBO similarly pandering to the people they call cultural interpreters?
In a way, I think the critics are, in the same way that the networks test shows with focus groups, which is, you know, average Americans sitting in a mall somewhere toggling switches back and forth. HBO tested shows with critics. I would take issue with the word pandering because the implication of pandering is that you're serving something up that you believe is beneath the mark that you could actually hit.
Fair enough.
And I think HBO is certainly aiming to please critics, and their theory is that that has a snowball effect where if the critics like it, then people read the newspapers, and it, the show becomes a kind of gradually a cultural phenomenon the way The Sopranos has.
HBO can show whatever they want to show, and what they want to show is autopsies in 6 Feet Under or beating strippers to death in The Sopranos or homosexual rape in Oz. Now, they would say they're just going where the stories take them, but if they didn't have those very graphic and shocking scenes, would they be able to say it's not TV, it's HBO?
They never quite come out and say this, but they certainly like to get headlines and have people be titillated and shocked. Tom Fontana, the creator of Oz, told me that he was always being told by the HBO people to not to be afraid to be reviled.
But HBO hires people like David Chase of The Sopranos, Alan Ball of 6 Feet Under, Tom Fontana of Oz, to produce those programs that may be reflective of reality. Would HBO ever pick up Aaron Sorkin, the creator of West Wing, and say, come on down?
Well, the West Wing is a bit of a bugaboo at HBO. They talk about it a lot. Privately, because they're basically pissed off that it won the Emmy last year, and they can't believe it, and they think it's sugary and false and network TV at its finest, which they feel is anathema to what they're doing. I spoke to Aaron Sorkin about that very issue. I said, you know, what would your show be like if it were on HBO? And he said, it would be a better show. He said, you know, the President Bartlett could swear. We wouldn't have hired someone as handsome as Rob Lowe. We'd have a much more realistic-looking White House lawyer. And then he paused. He said, but I don't tend to write like that. And there is a self-selecting system. It's not that everyone wants to work at HBO and only the best people get chosen. Everyone who writes for HBO has written for the networks before. They don't take people from the movies. They take people from the networks who are fed up with that and want to do something a little different.
Tad Friend, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Tad Friend's article, The Next Big Bet, appeared in the May 14th issue of The New Yorker.
Under ratings pressure from HBO, the networks react.
Coming to CBS this fall, Touched by a Clergyman.
Johnny, how would you like to come back to the rectory and see the brass rubbings I made in Canterbury?
Rectory?
Touched by a Clergyman. Coming this fall to CBS, where the gospel is not always good news.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by Irene Trudell, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sean Landis and Kathleen Horn.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Mercury?
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.